Good morning. It is 9:05 a.m. It is the 26th of October, 2009. We are in the 6th floor conference room. This is conference room in the DNA building in Agatia, Guam. This is the hearing on appellant's appeal. This is otherwise known as a formal hearing or the hearing on the merits of the appeal. I am Anthony Camacho. I am the hearing officer presiding over these proceedings. Will the other members of the Office of Public Accountability please identify themselves for the record?
Doris Flores, Public Auditor.
Doris
Flores,
Audit Supervisor.
Anne Camacho, Admin Officer.
Will the appellant's counsel please identify himself for the record and any institutional representatives that are with him today?
Randall Cunliffe, legal counsel for Guam Community Improvement Foundation, and with me is Mr. Anthony Squirrel from Guam Community Improvement Foundation.
Thank you, Mr. Cunliffe. Will the purchasing agency's counsel please identify himself for the record and any institutional representatives that are with him today?
I am Benjamin Abrams from the Guam Attorney General's office. I'm the Assistant Attorney General there, and I'm representing the Purchasing Authority, and I have with me today on my immediate right the Director of Public Works, who's the purchasing agent, Ms. Larry Perez.
Thank you, Mr. Abrams. Will the attorney for Interested Party IBC please identify herself for the record and any institutional representatives that are with her today?
Good morning. Okay,
and once again, will Mr. Verdaglio be joining you at the table today?
I think he's
supposed to. Okay. Well, Mr. Verdaglio, I note, is also listed as a witness. I believe he was called by the appellant. So if he's going to be seated in the back, he is going to have to leave with the rest of the witnesses. But as an institutional representative, just like Mr. Perez and just like Mr. Scrow, he can sit at the table if he wishes to be here throughout the entire proceeding.
Good. Good.
Yeah, well, all of the they're all witnesses, but I'm going to also allow them as an institutional representative. Which is typical in the court. Yeah. Yeah. Because there's a party. Now, while Mr. Verdaglio is making his way to the table, there is one preliminary matter that we have to discuss. Mr. Cunliffe has filed a motion to reconsider the decision and order the public auditor issued concerning the protective order. And as a point of order, we're going to hear that motion, okay? That motion is not going to be allowed to delay these proceedings. We are going to proceed. But the main issue is whether or not we're going to allow Mr. Cunliffe client access to the records he's seeking during the course of these proceedings. So my question to you, Mr. Abrams, and Ms. Tang is how soon can you file your response to that motion? Well, first of all, do you oppose it?
I'm opposed.
All right. How soon can you brief your opposition to that motion?
By tomorrow.
All right. And then, Mr. Cunliffe, how soon could you brief a reply if they you receive the opposition by tomorrow?
Well, if we receive it first thing in the morning, we can probably have a reply by noon. If we receive it by noon, we can probably have a response by 5 o'clock.
Well, I'm going to give them probably till 5 o'clock tomorrow. I think that's reasonable, because I think we'll probably be tied up in these proceedings for most of the day. And then I'll give you, let me see here.
And we would need till noon, I think, on Wednesday.
Wednesday? Okay. So, tomorrow the 27th, at 5 is when the oppositions to Mr. Cunliffe's motion to reconsider will be due by the purchasing agency and by the interested party. The reply will be due Wednesday at noon, you said, Mr. Cunliffe?
Yes.
Okay. Wednesday at noon, the 28th of October. And when do you want to hear the motion? In the afternoon? Depending on the hearing, I plan on having the hearing for Mr. Cumliff's motion to reconsider at 2 p.m. Okay? So if we're in the course of these proceedings, okay, at 2 p.m. on Wednesday, we will hear that motion. Okay? Any questions on that schedule? Okay. And I will submit an order concerning the same today.
May I be there on a related point?
Yes.
As I said before, when we were scheduling these 3 days for the hearing on Mr. Cummins' appeal, I do have a confirmed booking for Thursday morning. I'll be flying off of Guam Thursday morning. Since we set this hearing, I was confident that Mr. Weisenberger from our office could pinch it for me in the event that it went beyond Wednesday. But now I'm told by our deputy that Mr. Weisenberger will be assigned to some other litigation. So I think it's all on me, and I just won't be here after Wednesday afternoon until a week from Wednesday morning. Very early, I'm arriving on Wednesday, I believe it's the 5th, and I'll be coming in like at the crack of dawn. I could come to anything scheduled at 9 o'clock then.
Okay, Mr. Evans, let's take that issue up probably after we hear Mr. Cullen's motion on Wednesday.
Okay.
Okay, we'll see where we are at at that
okay,
point.
Okay, I just wanted to remind you because I didn't want to leave that for the last minute and say surprise, I'm not going to do that.
Pursuant to your prior disclosure of those facts, I'm well aware of your,
okay,
your
okay.
schedule. Are there any other preliminary matters that we need discussed before we begin the proceeding?
Well, yes. It's my understanding from procurement law and procurement appeals that the agency that has let the bid has to create a prima facie case. And would proceed with their case first. Mr. Abrams, when he came in, indicated he thought I was going first, and we need to, I guess, find out who's going first.
We are going to allow the appellant, okay, because that's kind of the order of the filings as well, all right? The order is that you state your appeal, okay? They state their response to the appeal. And as it's your appeal, you'll get the last word on it, Mr. Cunliffe. Okay? And we'll go forward in that manner pursuant to the scheduling order that we set out on October the 19th. Okay? And, or excuse me, not the 19th, I apologize. So, we're basically following and tracking the order of the formal filings in the case. You understand that, Mr. Cummins?
Yes, I do. I just,
okay.
In procurement law, well, the appellant doesn't go first in most jurisdictions.
Okay. Well, that particular issue here, okay, like I said, the formal hearing is tracking the filings, okay? Are you prepared to go first?
I was expecting the government to go first.
Did you get a copy of my October the 13th order?
I did.
And did you read on the second page, starting at around line 17, the part that said that the hearing will proceed in the following order, opening statements of the parties, and then, of course, the appellant's case in chief, followed by the purchasing agency's case in chief.
I'm just creating the record, Mr. Camacho.
Very well. Okay.
I understand the order.
All right.
I need to create the record.
Okay, now prior to starting these proceedings, are any of the party's witnesses located in the back of the room? Okay, I ask that the witnesses be sequestered and be asked to leave the room until called.
Mr. Ho has asked, this is Mr. Ho, the president of Cortec. He has asked Mr. Abrams if he could be on call. He's subpoenaed by Mr. Abrams. And he's been asking Mr. Abrams if he could be on call.
Okay, you need to work that out with Mr.
Right,
Abrams.
And so I think he asked him to wait until we determine who was going first.
Okay, well, I think we've determined that you, Mr. Cutliff, was even proceeding first.
Okay. May I inquire as to Mrs. Appleby? She was the coordinator between DOE and the and the construction of a new school. She was on a coordinating committee. She represents a real party of interest here, and she's requesting me to ask you if she could sit at council table.
That's UNITAP. No, the actual purchasing agency in this case is DPW, okay? So I'm going to allow you one institutional representative, and I believe that's Mr. Paris. Okay?
Fine.
Mr. Ho would also need to leave the room.
Could he be on call? Mm-hmm. No, on call, but maybe 2 or 4%.
Thank you, Mr. Ho.
Thank you very much.
Now, the other issue are cell phones. Is anybody's cell phone in the silent mode or on vibrate? I'm not going to hear any sirens, foghorns, birds chirping, I hope. If your cell phone is not capable of silent mode, I ask you to please shut it off. And that goes for everybody in the audience in the back of the room as well. All right. Now, having said all that, we're going to proceed to the, are there any other preliminary matters before we proceed?
No.
All right, so we're now going to begin with the hearing on the appellant's appeal, and we're going to proceed with opening statements. Mr. Cunliffe, this is your appeal. The floor is yours for your opening statement.
Thank you, Mr. Camacho. The matter before this body is not something that I need to get into at any great length. Everybody knows why we're here. The situation is one in which the Guam legislature passed some legislation that authorized DPW to issue an RFP and to issue regulations in furtherance of that RFP if necessary. The public auditor has received the record of the procurement, which the appellant has not received because it has been held to be privileged, the documents contained therein, so that we don't have any firsthand knowledge about what is contained in the records of the procurement before this body. There are documents that have indicated that the procurement or the certificates of participation, which are going to be the financial documents upon which the government and IBC were going to go forward in this case, were to be issued in New York. And they were to be D-rated certificates of participation with a cost of $69 million. That significantly exceeds the financial terms and conditions in any of the proposals submitted to the public auditor as part of this appeal, and indicates the fact that we believe that the party with whom they had selected in this case to go forward, IBC, did not have the financial capability of doing this project in the amount and in the condition which they submitted their proposals to Department of Public Works. In fact, we believe that the financial terms are 50% higher than what they had proposed as AAA bonds to be their financing mechanism in this case. We believe the record already establishes that the selection letter, which was admitted in the motions hearing in this case, dated in January 15th, I believe, or January 16th of 2009, was not actually signed off on by the director until March 5th of 2009, and then it took another 8 months, or I mean 5 months, for the IBC to find any financing which did not comport directly with what was in their bid. And we believe we will be able to establish that, that they were out seeking financing between January 2009 and August of 2009 from various areas of financing, and so that their bid or their proposal was in fact not a valid proposal because they didn't have financing available when they put that proposal, made that proposal available. The evidence, we believe, will establish that the financial criteria was ignored, although it was supposed to be 70% of the value of the proposals, and that the proposal that is currently before the bodies has no apparent connection to the original proposal submitted. It is so much more expensive than initially offered that the public auditor will have to find that the body to whom the award has been apparently sought is not competent, was not a responsive proposal, and we will establish that the apparent lessee, CAPPA, the partner of IBC.
Excuse me, I hate to interrupt any lawyer making an opening statement. It's not evidence. However, I feel like that I have to protect the record and protect the interests of the purchasing attorney. I'm making an objection based on this legal principle. Mr. Cunliffe now is going into a matter involving capital, which was not in his DCI's protest. This is one of the things that came out after the protest on the appeal. Now, we're going to meet decisions head on either now or in due course during these proceedings, but I'm objecting at the first incident of this, and Mr. Cunliffe is now saying he's going to prove something that was never in the protest, and by extension, the Department of Public Works, the purchasing authority, never had the chance to deny or give credence to. It was never before the purchasing authority, but he can't raise it for the first time on appeal. So this and other parts of his appeal, which are at variance with his protest, I believe, cannot be alluded to in this appeal.
Mr. Cunliffe. Well, first of all, Ms. Tang.
We're joining that objection.
Okay. Mr. Cunliffe.
If this body rules evidence is not admissible, then he can say Mr. Cunliffe didn't prove what he said he was going to prove. An opening statement.
I tend to agree with that, Mr. Abrams. Okay, you can address that in your opening statement, and certainly at the end of the case, you can also address that in your closing statement. Okay? and Cunliffe, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Muncher.
Objection overruled. Please proceed.
The evidence we believe will establish that CAFRA does not have a license to be a landlord and lease property within the territory of Guam, and did not have one at the time that this bid was put in place, and therefore in violation of the law, which requires you to be licensed in order to make the bids that you're making. And therefore, we believe that they are not a proper, this is not a proper proposal, and in violation of the law, and therefore also should be denied. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cunliffe. Mr. Abrams, opening statement.
Thank you, Mr. Hearing Officer. In listening to the opening statement by GCIF, I noticed that two of the no-nos that I believe apply to this hearing are going to come into play. And the first of those negatives is that, according to any procurement law that I've ever seen, in fact, in the broader sense, any appellate law, the reviewing body can only consider matters which were brought before the lower hearing body in the first instance. And there's a good reason for this. And that reason is, unless you have the lower hearing body given a chance to rule one way or the other on matters of protest, it can't be raised for the first time after he has passed judgment on the protest, because it circumvents the authority of the purchasing agent to have that done. Just like in a trial in Superior Court or Federal Court, there's a trial, and then on appeal, the appellant seeks to raise a factual or a legal issue that was never presented during the trial. There's no way that it can be heard on appeal. So that's the first barrier I think Mr. Cunliffe has to face. The second one is by virtue of the Earth Protective Order entered by the OPA here. And that, of course, precludes evidence of any proprietary, confidential, secret, sealed matter that was indicated as such when we filed our exhibits in our rendition of the procurement record. So I think those are two obstacles that GCIC really has to face. GCIF, I'm sorry. I heard Mr. Cunliffe mention, I believe, that he had not received a procurement record. Well, I think he has, but possibly he misspoke when he said that. We had served on Mr. Cunliffe's office a sanitized version, if you will, of the procurement record, which at that point did not include any of the matters which we designated as proprietary in nature. So he has access to all of the documents of public record, and that all that constituted at least half, if not more than half, of the entire procurement record. So he does have that. And he has copies of all of our exhibits that were not shielded by the protective order ruling. Now, when I mentioned the protective order ruling, it's my view. I don't know if it will be shared by the hearing officer and the public auditor or not, but it's something we've thought about since we got the protective order, and although the protective order doesn't address this matter, we see it as being retrospective as well as prospective. In other words, if there are things that managed to wiggle out or come to the surface before the protective order was entered, thereby precluding any exclusion at the time they may have come out, we think this is premature, and we think that the protective order ought to be retroactive retroactive in application as it pertains to anything that's privileged. So these are the comments that I would make by way of an opening statement. And at the end of Mr. Cumber's case, there may be further presentation on the testimony and the evidence that Mr. Cumber may adduce. But I have nothing further to add at this time. Unless there are any questions, that will conclude my opening remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Abrams. Ms. Tang, any opening statement?
Very short, thank you. Good morning. Good morning. Many of the things that may fall out of the hearing relating to the council and the I'd like to just add that we do agree that the issues in this appeal are limited to the framed by the court that committed by GCRS, which is set forth in the August of 2009 letter. Many appeals, issues are framed in this, but we can't expand it afterwards for very good reasons. And the agency did respond, and the response was in August 11th letter. There were five issues that were addressed in that agency response, that was to repair. And this issue really has to do with the RFP, the financing package, the way to how the RFP weighs the financing, and certain reviews reports and allegations made by GCIF with respect to the procurement issue. And I think that this the hearing on the merits should be limited to only that. And for that reason, we believe that any issues relating to your proposals, aside from it being commentary and determining and having granted the motion for the purchase order, I think that that would not be a proper area for review at this hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tang. I know that I believe some people have walked into the courtroom since you started the opening. Can the parties just verify that there are no witnesses seated in the audience? Likewise, Mr. Lester Carlton and Mr. Anthony Blas are out there. They're requesting to come in, but just verifying, are they also witnesses or listed as witnesses by the parties?
They're on our list.
Very well. Okay. So they're going to remain sequestered outside.
I sent a message with one of the staff here to them that unfortunately they would have to wait outside.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Abrams. Okay. So we've concluded the opening statements. We're now going to proceed to the appellant case in chief, Mr. Cumliff.
We'll call Lawrence Ferris.
Ms. Ann Camacho to come and get you signed and sworn, Mr. Perez. So sorry for the delay.
Will
be the truth, the whole truth, and
nothing but the truth. Mr. Cumliff, your witness. Thank you. Mr. Perez, would you please tell us where you work?
I'm the director of the Guam Department of Public Works.
And how long have you held that position?
four and a half years.
And before that, where were you employed?
I was the general manager of the Guam Telephone Authority.
And how long did you hold that position?
2 years.
Now, are you familiar with the request for proposal that was submitted by Public Works for the design, the finance design and construction of JFK High School?
Yes, I am.
And how are you familiar with that?
I'm familiar in terms of Public Law 29-104 and the executive fund meeting provided to me from my division staffers on the RFP specifications, as well as having to get a little bit more into the reading specs of the reason.
And when was the executive summary prepared for you?
It was prepared for me when there was this recent protest.
So prior to the actual RFP going out?
No, this was after the RFP going out.
So you were made aware of this RFP details afterwards?
That's correct.
Were you familiar with the public law 29-114?
Yes, I am.
And were you familiar with that prior to the RFP going out?
Yes, I was.
Okay. And did it give you any authority, that public law?
Yes, it did.
And what authority did it give you?
As the contracting officer for the procurement of this tender.
And in that regard, what did you understand your authority to be other than just procurement?
For the components for the design and build of the tenant, as you all know, it was issued as a finance design build maintain and VSPAC RP. The DPW also, as part of the overall contracting officer for the procurement, was passed with the code regulations for the construct of the building.
And before the protest was filed, did you have any involvement with the evaluation of the office, the
yes.
proposal?
Yes, I was.
And what was your involvement?
In the beginning, since the advertisement of the tender, it was a pre-bid conference, at which time I participated in, just to provide clarity. And subsequent agenda ensued. Also, when the submissions were, when the offers, proposals were submitted on the due date, subsequent to that, I had a meeting with the, we had to select the committee members for the session committee review, or review committee. And then I convened a meeting with the committee members to get them up to speed on the urgency, as well as key components that they needed to address in the tender.
Now, how were the committee members selected?
Our normal practice in the DPW for all our tenders is, depending on who's a customer that this tender is going to benefit, we normally assigned, three or four members of that customer. Certainly we bring in the expertise, committee members that have expertise in different areas. Because it involves financial, we brought in a GEDA representative. Because it dealt with construction, we brought in a couple DPW representatives. And then because the customer themselves is a lot of exclusive funds, I believe we brought in four of those representatives.
And who selects those members?
It is a recommendation by our team, the chief engineer of EPW as well as a deputy manager, who I asked to oversee all vertical activities. And based on those recommendations, I basically sign off on the selection.
And who signs off on it? Who's the one who actually appoints them?
I am.
And before you signed off or appointed anyone, did you go over their qualifications?
No, I did not.
Now, in the procurement law, what is your understanding that RFPs are used for?
RFPs are used for professional consulting services to include all the engineering and architectural and mastering disciplines. It's also used for areas where best value is preferred as opposed to low bid. And it's also used as a mechanism for tenders where there's uncertainty, where there's a need for negotiation. And those are basically three, to the best of my knowledge, that I recollect are instances where we would use the RFP method.
And in the construction of schools, the legislature within the recent past has authorized schools to be constructed using RFPs. Is that correct?
For this particular tender, it was specified to be an RFP.
Okay. And were the you were given authority to create rules and regulations with regard to the RFP and how it would be issued?
We were given authority to establish the specifications and boilerplates associated with this tender to be in compliance with all federal and local laws, as well as all governing building and construction codes.
Okay. As the director of the agency, were you authorized to, in the recent past, to create regulations in order to have a RFP fit into a construction project?
I can't comment to the fact that there was a law out there that authorized us or required that we create those regulations. But under the umbrella of the RFP, we have used the RFP methodology for previous contracting activities. The one prior to this where we used this example was actually for the turnkey finance design build maintain leaseback of the four schools. It has been done in prior procurements outside of my umbrella or my administration, but it's not like we need to create something new to implement this particular RFP. The precedent has been set in DPW in decades past.
Let me just ask you this in response to your answer, Mr. Perez. The previous RFPs for the other schools, did they occur before you became director? They did?
They commenced before I was the director, but they were finalized when I became the director.
So the RFPs were actually issued before you were the director?
That's correct.
And what is your understanding of the basic terms and conditions of this RFP with regard to what was going to happen? What was going to happen as far as the contractor and the government law?
I'm not sure. We were actually governed by the representation in the RFP itself. So I guess if you can be a little bit more specific, governing administrative regarding the contracts themselves, or
I mean, this was intended to have somebody build a school?
Absolutely.
Finance that construction of that school?
Yes. Okay.
Then lease some property to someone, the bidder or the proposer?
Okay.
And then lease the property back from them?
That's correct.
Okay.
As well as maintain the facility that's constructed.
And the proposer would maintain it for the next 30 years?
That's correct.
And insure it?
Yes, the whole cradle to grave, all components associated. There's a lot of nuances that weren't necessarily spelled out in the RP, but it's under the catch-all caveat of and all activities and all associated transactions necessary to continue this in a legitimate fashion for the next 30 years.
Now, when the RFP was issued, were there any addendums made to that RFP?
Yes, there were.
And just in general, what was the purpose of those addendums?
To my recollection, and again, I don't have the agenda in front of me, but I believe one of them was minutes of meetings at the first Kirby conference, which provided the necessary clarity. Another one was, again, I go to a lot of RPs and invitations to visit, so I'm thinking one of them would be an extension request, time extension. But I prefer to just withhold any further comment until I actually see the agenda. There's many that I go through on many different tenders.
Was this a time-sensitive project?
Absolutely.
Okay. And why was it a time-sensitive project?
From the onset, we had the citations from the Attorney General's office. There was a crisis in terms of safety and putting the kids in harm's way. So. The school was actually determined to be shut down, and that was one. The other is the statute itself that was created, 29114, clearly mandated by policy, but we need to put this in the front burner and expedite the construct of a new JFP. And then, and then more recently, what further affirmed it was the overcrowding in GFU and the inadequate education being had. And then the last one would be this temporary use of the student facility that's only funded for one fiscal year, and it's unknown whether or not we'll get funding for subsequent years.
Okay, now the public law 29114 mandated certain timelines.
That's correct.
And one of those timelines gave you, I believe, 30 days to issue the RFP.
It did give us a prescribed time frame.
And then, and an RFP, is there a specific time frame that someone has to respond to that?
Yes, there is.
And is it contained in the RFP or is it contained in the law?
It's contained in the RFP.
And was that also set by the legislature?
No, it was not set by the legislature. Our read of the statute was that we were to issue a request for proposal, not necessarily a award of a proposal, but the issuance of an RP, advertisement and document.
Now, the law also provided that once the contract is entered into, there's 9 months to complete the contract. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And were there any terms and conditions as to what would happen if it was not completed in 9 months?
It was not in the statute itself.
Now, after
the notice of, to the various parties that you were going to be discussing this RFP, that the number one awardee was IDC. Do you recall that about, I think you inked it, or signed a letter and put a date of, I think, March 5th, 2009, on or about?
That's correct.
Did you then begin negotiations with IDC?
Upon signing the letter, absolutely.
Okay. And how soon after the signing of the letter did you begin those negotiations?
Upon the selection of the committee members, and then the actual rating and ranking, the effort done by the selection committee members, the rating and ranking done, it was almost immediately after the selection where we started to commence our negotiations. There's a chronology that was provided in the exhibit that we show when those things occurred.
Okay. I know we asked this question before at a previous hearing, but I think on January 16th, a letter was dated at the top of the letter indicating that GCIF was not the number one selectee.
I have an objective so far, because I don't want to slow things down, but I do believe that this matter was not raised in the protest. We're getting into some, if I understand the line of questioning correctly, we're getting, Mr. Cunliffe is trying to suggest through these questions and answers, that there was some mistake made by the Department of Public Works as a purchasing authority in not proceeding quickly enough or something. And this was never raised in the protest, so this is another example of how I feel. Mr. Cunliffe has to be held to the letter, to the black and white of his protest, and there was nothing about this in his protest.
Mr. Cunliffe, your response?
Yes, Mr. Camacho. I'm trying to lay the timeline foundations and trying to determine which may be subject to future objections by management as to why the funding wasn't in place by IDC as it was supposed to have been pursuant to the RFP, and what processes they went through in order to find financing on behalf of IDC.
Just briefly, this will take forever, and what I'm trying to do is inject a little precision and tighten up the scope of what Mr. Cunliffe is trying to do. Now, he's filed a protest. The protest was denied. He took it up on appeal. He should be asking questions that illustrate the correctness of his protest. And this is not going to do that. And just going all over the place about laying foundations for this and that. If he wants to lay a foundation for something that is embodied in his protest, fine. That's what I expect him to do. But we're not getting anywhere with this line of questioning. It's way wide in the scope of his protests, and that's why I reluctantly had to object.
Well, I believe Mr. Cunliffe is merely establishing the timeline as to what took place during the purchasing agency's conduct of the solicitation. So I'm going to overrule your protest and allow Mr. Cunliffe to proceed with his line of questioning. Mr. Cunliffe, you may proceed.
I'm trying to remember what my question was. there was a letter dated, I believe, January 16th, 2009. At the top of the letter, it was typed in, advising Guam Community Improvement Foundation that they had not been selected, that you were going to begin negotiations with the first selected person, the highest rated offeror or proposer, and that they would be, you know, held in abeyance or kept in line in case those negotiations didn't come to fruition. That's the letter that you actually signed, I believe, on March 5th. Why did it take from January 16th to March 5th for you actually to sign the letter that was dated January 16th?
Excuse me, same objection to that question. He's trying to find fault with the purchasing authority's actions or inaction by asking this kind of question, and it was never included in the purchase. Thank you.
Mr. Cullum?
We have testimony that it's a time-sensitive matter. We have objected to the fact that the bid that has been placed, or the proposal that is now on board before this body, is not the best and the most conforming bid or proposal to come in. And it is our understanding, although we don't have the documents in front of us, because they've been marked to be privileged, that the amount of money that was initially proposed and the type of financing that was initially proposed by IBC is not what is now on the table with this proposal. And in order to establish our position, we need to go through these various steps and find out exactly what the procedure was and why. Because they have 9 months from the signing of the contract, so you can delay your negotiations for 2 years and still meet the requirement of the contract. And our position has been and still is that IBC did not have financing in place when they submitted this proposal, and we need this kind of testimony to establish that.
Mr.
Abrams? That's fine. If he wants to go into finance, he raised financing in his protest. If he wants to ask a question that relates to that, fine. But the last question as to why he didn't sign a letter that has nothing to do with finance within a certain time window doesn't have anything to do with it.
Mr. Abrams, I'm going to once again overrule your objections. I'm going to allow Mr. Cullum to continue his line of questioning. These are relevant to establishing the procedures the purchase agency used in processing the solicitation, this particular solicitation. Please proceed, Mr. Cullum.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Parrish, do you remember the question?
Can you rephrase it just to make sure I'm saying it right?
Sure. A letter was drafted with the date January 16th, telling GCIF that they were not the number one ranked proposer. That letter was actually signed by you, I believe, on March 5th. Do you know why there was such a delay between January and March in signing of that document?
Well, first of all, I want to clarify something. One is I put the date that I sign any document as of the day that I actually sign it. I read the document, sign it. There are preliminary documents that come before my desk that lead up to that actual cover letter that says this is the ranking, notify everybody. So the selection committee members would have this rating and ranking of all their reviews, and I would sign that, and then a subsequent cover letter usually ensues. I need to get back to the actual record to see what transpired in between, but it's actually realistic that the date of an activity completing the date that I signed it is a gap, only because of internal reviews, internal bureaucracy, and whatnot. But nothing I guess out of the usual at the DPW for this to occur.
Okay. So, as I understand your answer, then this is just the normal time it takes after the review is done for the finalization to be...
I'm not commenting to the point of time. It's more so our normal operations does have these steps. You have a meeting, or you have a closure of an actual activity. There's preparation of it, I sign off on it, and then there's an ensuing document to notify people, notify of the next steps, and even conduct the next, I guess, negotiations, level negotiations. Okay. But it's not normal, but it's I guess, an acceptable activity, especially when you're dealing with the magnitude of this type of attendance.
And between January 15, 2009 and March, when you signed the letter, did anyone discuss the proposal directly with IBC?
That's possible, and it is allowable. Especially if you're trying to get clarification.
And if you can recall, if it did occur, what kind of clarification would you be looking for?
No, I do object to that question. It's asking for the substance of the discussion with IBC, and I believe that would be privileged.
We'll be joining that objection. That, I believe that form part of the procurement record.
Mr. Carmel? Oh,
thank you. Yes, thank you, Mr. Camacho. I mean, that's one of the difficulties we have here. I don't know what the discussion was. I don't know if it's privileged. I don't know how we find out if it's privileged unless he answers the question. You may be in camera to the hearing officer. I mean, this body has to make a determination. The public auditor has to make a determination with your assistance as to the viability of this procurement, whether it was done properly based upon the protests we filed. And I know that the record exists before the public auditor. I know that it's been ruled to be privileged, and so the public auditor can review it. And I'm trying to create a record to establish certain answers and certain information, which I don't have, and I'm not privy to, which may assist the public auditor and yourself in making the determination on this procedure.
Also, the form of the question is objectionable. He asked the witness, did anyone, anyone in the world or anyone at DOE or anyone that he knows of, or is this too broad? It lacks specificity.
Okay. I'm going to basically rule that pursuant to decision and order concerning the purchasing agency's motion for protective order that Mr. Cummins, you are limited and may not go into the statements made by the interested party IBC during their negotiations. Pursuant to that protective order, those are sealed at this time. Okay, you may proceed. Likewise, if there are any information that is contained in their proposal, that may not be looked into at this time as well. Please proceed.
May I ask a question that might assist me? You've indicated
you may rephrase your question.
We've indicated that I can't ask about any statements made by IBC, but may I ask about statements made by the procuring agency as to what they were seeking from IBC?
Same objection. What they were seeking, that's proprietary. They may have been seeking something that's very confidential. We just can't go into the substance
of what it is they were looking for with IBC. What did you ask them? It would be the same question.
Well, we asked them what the tensile strength was, or, I'm just picking that as a hypothetical, but if it gets into that kind of thing, I believe that's within the scope of the protected order.
I'd like to just add one more point. Providing authority for GR, to GAR, that's a section here. 3114, subsection, I believe it is H, section 1-1. It says that it refers to the discussion permissible between the procuring the head of the agency who's conducting the procurement. And then on the subsection 2, no disclosure information, there's a board in this code which allows them to discuss with the various proposers and deems this discussion confidential.
I'm going to sustain the objection now, Mr. Cunliffe. As to your question, okay, I do believe, though, that what you can inquire is maybe when these discussions took place, but not what information was discussed pursuant to the protective order. Please proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Perez, you indicated that you had questions to get clarification of some issues. When were those questions first made to IBC?
I know it's definitely after I received notice from the selection committee of who was selected, but I don't know the exact dates and what exactly was discussed.
After the selection committee made their selection, did you have any more involvement with the selection committee?
Yes, just one other time.
And when was that?
I don't know the exact date, but I know the location. It was at the GEDA conference room.
And what was the purpose of that meeting with the selection committee?
Was to get important to the discussion team of meetings as part of the procurement record was beyond the scope.
Purpose goes in the substance of the discussion. And let's say, for example, the purpose was to evaluate certain type of findings. You know, that if there was a discussion about financing, that's a very sensitive matter. Let's say that the purpose of the discussion was about how collateral equipment is and what consists of other money. This is all proprietary, and we join in the objection on this thing.
Mr. Cunliffe, yes, this was a discussion with the selection committee, not with IBC. I don't see how it's proprietary to IBC.
That's the very thing I'm trying to say. You know, to be honest with you, what the selection committee deliberated about, that can't be, that has got to be within the scope of the protective order.
Ms. Tang?
I'm referring back to the same statute. The discussions and the information that was given by the parties during the negotiation, during the evaluation and the negotiation are proprietary until there's been an award. This is a protesting the ranking, not the award. So for that reason, all that information is confidential under Guam procurement law. And they're just trying to get around this by arguing that we're just trying to understand what really happened in the timeline. But we're getting into the substance here, and that is protected under Guam procurement law. Thank you.
Not only that, Mr. Camacho, but don't you think that this is a little bit irrelevant in terms of the scope of their protest? Where in their protest did they get into any of this? I think they have to adhere to the scope of their protest. They could have amended the protest. They could have filed another protest, but they never did that. So this is another thing that's extraneous to the protest itself. Okay?
Mr. Cunliffe, any response briefly?
My understanding, Mr. Camacho, is that the selection committee had made a decision selecting this group. The selection committee was then, I don't know what relevance they had anymore. They had already made a selection of who would be the number one, number two, and number three selections would be in this case. And now there's a further meeting between the Director of Public Works and the selection committee. And I'm just trying to inquire what the purpose of that meeting was.
going back to the protective order that was issued by the public auditor, what is protected is that are the proposals submitted by the offerors. Likewise, any documents in the procurement record that contain any information from the proposals. Okay. However, I do note that what is always part of the public portion of every procurement record are the dates that there were meetings by the purchasing agency concerning the procurement. Likewise, any communications between any party and any of the offerors, those are the public portions of the procurement record. I am going to overrule the objection as it relates to questions pertaining to the dates of these meetings, the purpose of these meetings as well. I made my ruling.
Well, I understand that, and that ruling has been made. But there was an additional ground for the objection, Mr. Camacho, and that is, I don't recall in the protest him, GCIF, alleging any error by the selection committee. I never saw anything in the protest that had anything at all to do with ranking. So this is at variance with the protest itself. It was never properly raised in the protest. It was never ruled upon by the purchasing authority. And it's too late to bring up new matters on this appeal. Thank you.
Let's follow up on the issue of relevancy.
Again, because we don't have the documents, we haven't seen these things. I mean, it's hard for me to tell. When he answers the questions, it may turn out it isn't relevant. But because we are not able to see numerous documents that they have declared to be proprietary, and they don't want us to go into any discussions that may have taken place, that this body and the public auditor are going to have to determine whether or not the way the selection was made, the values put on various documents, how they came about the selection, and potentially changes in that selection, which, you know, for the first time we're hearing today, we think they are relevant before this body. And this isn't a jury. This isn't something that you yourself or the public auditor can't completely ignore if you find it's not relevant.
He just wasn't in his presence. He never alleged any kind of wrongdoing by the selection committee. He never alleged anything unusual or improper about the ranking. And those are the things we're wasting time on now. And I just think that Mr. Conliff has to stick to the issues raised in his protest, and this never was part of the protest.
I'm going to rule that the line of questioning as to the times of the meetings and Mr. Conliff's line of questioning pertains to are relevant to the matters in his protest. Mr. Conliff, please proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Perez, you indicated you don't recall exactly the date, but after the selection had been made, you had a meeting with the selection committee at GEDA at another time. What was the purpose of that meeting?
I'm going to make the same objection.
And then I'm going to make the same ruling, Mr. Abrams.
Okay.
This is the same question that he asked. And we can continue going on, but it's the same question that he asked, that you made your objection to, which I've already ruled on. Is that correct?
That's what I wrote down.
Please proceed, Mr. Kummer. I've already made a ruling on that question.
Okay. My recollection of that meeting was, first of all, to get an introduction of all the players. This is the first time I would have actually met with the selection committee members. And I needed to convey key points of information for the selection committee in their going forward negotiations with the contractor. One is the cameras are looking at what's happening. We have to make sure that because this is issued as a turnkey finance design build maintain lease back, it's going to be very similar to the last committee that we had for the four schools. That we're talking about cradle to grave, a full operation fully constructed, fully operational school for the kids. And this includes the financing component, the construct of the building, the maintenance of the building, the leaseback arrangement, and any other nuances associated to make sure that we don't have or that the fiduciary interest of the government is protected. We made mention of why there was the composition of the membership. When we talk about school equipment, the only ones that know anything about school equipment is the committee members that were from the schools. When it came to the construct of this facility, there's a reason why there's two public works folks in this. And when it comes to the actual financing, there's a GITA folks and their underwriters, they have to do what they need to do. And I wanted to get across to the committee members that there's a crisis out there and that they need to assure that they have dedicated means to address everything from the construct of the building, the maintenance of the building, the grounds, the maintenance of the building, and the collateral equipment, there you go. So that was basically what I left the team with. I asked them to take a look at the old tender, the old negotiations for the four schools, and see areas of improving on the negotiations, basically lessons learned, best management practices, and you know, there's a lot of successes with the last tender, the tender prior to this one, but there's always room for improvement. So basically it was a pep talk that I was offering to the committee.
Were the selection committee members involved with the negotiations after the bid was, the selection was made?
They had to, and they're designated to be negotiators.
Mm-hmm. Now, the RFP itself had the collateral equipment listed in it, did it not?
Yes, it did.
And it had the other terms and conditions listed in it?
They had terms and conditions listed in the specs, yes.
Now, without explaining, you know, giving me any details, in the negotiations were the terms and conditions of the RFP modified?
Yes.
And are those modifications reduced to writing?
Yes.
And are they part of the procurement record?
Because it was submitted by the contractor, I don't necessarily know that's true.
You don't know whether they are or not?
Can I explain what I mean by that?
He's your witness, Mr. Clement.
I have no objection to explaining. I don't know if they're going to say it's protected state.
Well, here's what it is. I understand submissions by a contractor is confidential. The procurement record is not confidential or releasable. But there are dialogues that are occurring that the contractor is giving us. But I'm not necessarily sure that I can release this thing without breaching the contractor's, I don't know what you call that.
There's a representative objecting any part of the answer that goes to the content and the substance of these discussions as being protected.
My worry is...
Okay, I'm confident that if we approach that type of sensitive matter that Mr. Abrams or Ms. Tang will diligently make the objection at the proper time to that question or to that portion of your answer. So please proceed, Mr. Cumliff.
Yes. I guess what I've asked, Mr. Paris, was there have been modifications in writing to the RFP, is what your testimony was.
They were negotiated documents binding between the selection committee and the contractor. That were effectuated in writing, yes.
Okay. And you're not sure whether they have been submitted as part of the procurement record?
They should not have been submitted as part of the procurement record. Again, my worry is violating that negotiation based on what a contractor submitted to us. I personally would direct to not make it a releasable information until a contract is awarded, if any.
I guess the reason I asked is you were quoted in the media saying that there have been changes made to the project.
I'm saying absolutely there were changes in every component. But that was the whole representation at the onset of the RFP. It was clearly represented that this is at a high level, this is what we see it to be in the representation, and that there will be ongoing negotiations for each of the components, for all the nuances associated for each of those components. It varies from contractor to contractor.
Is, without answering how, is the financial component that you're now discussing different than the financial component contained in the RFP?
No. And I need to qualify that also.
Go ahead.
Each of the components, the ground lease, the construct of the building, the maintenance and the financing. It was generically written to accommodate the widest scope of possible offers that are out there. So in terms of the integrity of the intent of the RP, in terms of the integrity of the Public Law 29114, we have not changed whatsoever. But in terms of the variability within those parameters, It has changed. There are some nuances that have to be changed for each of those categories. And again, that's just the whole nature of the beast. That's the nature of this RFP. It was clearly represented that each component was to be negotiated, fine-tuned with each of the contractors, or let's say with the highest rank and going down to each one of them, if we have to go down to the last, we would have those detailed discussions.
Have there been discussions with any proposer besides IBC?
No, just the IBC and their team.
Yeah, the other proposers would be GCIF and GEFF.
Okay, I'm pursuant to the protective order, okay? The registrar of proposers isn't allowable, Mr. Cunliffe.
I'm sorry, the registrar?
The disclosure of who made proposals, that's pursuant to the protective order. That's also an area that's who else made proposals, basically. That's also an area that's not, although it may be widely known, nevertheless, we're still protecting the registrar of proposals. Okay. I'm going to limit you in your questioning concerning that issue pursuant to protective order, which is...
I will rephrase the question. I understood your testimony to mean there were a number of proposers which had groups of people in each unit of a proposal, and your discussions only took place with the number one awardee.
Okay.
and their group.
Okay.
Thank you. And previously, I think it was testified to that the, in an earlier hearing, that the public law which created the temporary campus for JFK also required that all collateral equipment purchased for that temporary campus be used for this project, which is the subject of this RFP, the actual re-siting of JFK.
I'm not too versed in the other tender for, that tender was handled by the GSA, so I'm not up to speed on all their nuances and even the governing statute, so I can't comment.
Now, one of the terms of the RFP and included in addendum number two.
Please speak into the mic, Mr. Clement.
From scope of work, Roman numeral 3H, was the ability of the lessor to provide 100% financing for the facility as being followed by the government. You recall that requirement?
Yes, and I also want to say that the overriding parameters is Public Law 29114, which also allows for other alternative solutions. Financing solutions, that is.
That's not in play at this time.
It's always in play from the onset.
I mean, as far as this RFP and this proceeding before the public auditor, we're only dealing with this RFP, which is a finance construct project.
I guess I'm not really understanding the statement itself.
Well, the appeal that we're here for is based upon an RFP for the finance design and construction of JFK.
Excuse me, that's not a question. Mr. Conniff is making statements, but there's no question to the witness to answer. So I object to that.
Okay. Mr. Conniff, at this time, I know you may have a response, but I'm going to have to agree that the last statement was... Okay, please ask the witness a question.
He has indicated he didn't understand, so I was prefacing the question. Okay. Was the RFP for the financing, design, and construction of JFK?
Yes, it was.
Okay. The law that you spoke of permitted other forms of the construction that didn't include the financing that would be found elsewhere. That's what you were referring to.
Yes, there's a section that actually... a complete section that deals with the financing,
right,
and all possible alternatives.
But what we're dealing with here is this RFP, is that correct?
Public Law 29114 is this RFP. I'm really not understanding your line of question.
Public Law 29114, did it authorize you to issue an RFP?
Yes, it did.
And it authorized you to issue that RFP in various forms?
Yes, it did.
And you chose one form, which was the finance, design, and construct?
That's correct.
Okay. And that's what now is before the public auditor, that RFP of finance, design, and construct?
That's correct.
And as you testified earlier, it included a leaseback provision?
That's correct.
Okay. So that the lessor would have leased it back, the building, back to the government of Guam, Department of Education.
That's correct.
Okay. And to your understanding, who is that lessor in this RFP that you're now negotiating?
See, these answers, such as the last one, represent, if I may just comment on this, represent an ongoing procurement process if the substantial interest determination is confirmed
this process will move ahead. But right now it's embryonic. It's a work in progress. There's been no award, there's been no final configuration of these things that Mr. Cunliffe is asking. And to elicit a response as to who the lessee is going to be, well, first of all, it's conjecture because we don't know that yet. Secondly, it's germane to the sensitive discussions that are taking place pursuant to the procurement law. So I do need to strike that answer. I don't want that answer in the record so Mr. Cunliffe can use it for whatever mileage he wants to get, because number one, it's not invisible, and number two, it's inconclusive at this point. We don't have an award yet.
Mr. Cunliffe?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Camacho. I have some documents that we will be introducing at a later time, which indicate, number one, a lease has been entered into, number two, that the lessee is CAPFA, and if that's false, then people have been committing fraud in the sale of certificates of participation in New York, a federal crime.
Now, these are records that exist, you mentioned, separate and apart from this procurement record. Is that correct?
Yeah, they were published on the Internet.
Yes, Mr. Abrams.
Whether that's true, whether that isn't true, what we're left with is something that's outside the scope of the protest. Nowhere in the protest does Mr. Cunliffe talk about CAPFA, or whether CAPFA's participation in this emerging deal, because it's not a deal yet, is legal or illegal. Nowhere in the protest did GCIF say anything about whether there was a lease that was improper or not proper or proper. It never came up. These are matters that, by no stretch of anyone's imagination, were even indirectly referred to in the protest. So that's the basis for the objection, as much as the confidentiality of the record.